Hi, everyone. Welcome to OEM TV. I'm Eric Mills from Microsoft. I do Windows Server marketing. We've got another awesome video for you here on server consolidation. So this is the second video in the server consolidation series. If you didn't see the first video, be sure to check that out because Jim takes you through the hardware sizing on server consolidation and how to think about CPU, RAM, and networking for that server consolidation project. But in this video, he's actually going to show you what it looks like on the Hyper-V host when you're adding those virtual machines that are going to be taking over for your physical machines during the server consolidation project. So he's going to show you how to add Hyper-V, which is really quick. He's going to show you how to manage the Hyper-V virtual machines from Hyper-V Manager, where to store those virtual disk files, where to store the virtual machine configuration files, the XML files that hold all the state information for the virtual machines. He's going to show you how to set it up for simultaneous live migration, so you can do multiple live migrations at the same time. How to set up Hyper-V replica, just the basics there. Gen 1 and Gen 2 virtual machines and dynamic memory. And then he spends a good amount of time on virtual switch manager. So how to create the virtual switches, connect the virtual machines to the virtual switches, and the different options that you have with virtual switches. So if all that sounds interesting, you're going to love this video. He's going to show you step by step how to set all this stuff up, and that should help you a ton in your next server consolidation project. So I hope you enjoy the video, and we'll see you next time on OEM TV.
Hello there. In this clip, we're going to go over some of the changes that will occur on your Windows Server 2012 machine when you get going with Hyper-V. The first thing you need to know is how to install Hyper-V. So from Server Manager, you're going to come down to Add Roles and Features. You're going to click Next. Role of Feature-Based Installation, you're going to click Next. Pick the server you want to install on. And then you're going to see that Hyper-V is already installed here, but you would just check Hyper-V and continue through the wizard. It's going to reboot you, and you're going to come back up, and you will have Hyper-V installed in your system. The next thing you want to do is get into the Hyper-V Manager console. So you just go to Tools, Hyper-V Manager. I've actually already got mine up and running. So it's single-seat administration, meaning that you can register multiple Hyper-V hosts inside of one console. We're going to focus on management from the Hyper-V Manager suite, but you can obviously go one step higher and scale this up to Microsoft Virtual Machine Manager, which is part of System Center, and that's really as you start getting into private cloud management. For standalone, we're going to be using Hyper-V Manager. All right, so some things you should set as soon as you set up Hyper-V for the first time. You should establish where you're going to be storing your virtual machine files and where you're going to be storing your virtual machine hard disks. In part one of server consolidation, we talked about separating the storage for your virtual machine guests from the storage on your management OS, which is what we're running right now. So if you do have a SAN out there, then probably the storage of your virtual hard disk files should be somewhere out on the SAN. If you're going to be using the Windows storage stack, which we recommend, then you're going to set up another either a SMB 3 share, which would just be on a standalone server, or more recommended would be a Windows Server cluster with a file server share on it. So one of the previous movies that we did, I showed you how to set up a Microsoft cluster and a scale-out file server. What we're doing when we set that up is we're setting up high availability storage. And the whole idea behind doing that in a cluster would be that the cluster storage would be resilient, and then the connectivity to the cluster would be highly available. And you can enhance that with NIC teaming, and you can enhance the speed with RDMA. So setting up your storage is really the first setting that you should do. To do that, you come down into Hyper-V settings, and you're basically going to provide paths. So in this case, we're using E: Hyper-V VHD just because we don't have SAN storage. But in this case, we would use, if we're going to use a scale-out file server, we'd go whack scale-out file server name / VHD or whatever the share was that you'd set up for virtual hard disks. Now, the virtual hard disk, this is just the default location when I create a new virtual machine where these virtual hard disks are going to go. You can relocate these. You can move these dynamically while the virtual machine's running. If you end up putting them on local storage and you want to move them into the cluster, that's what live migration is for. You can do a storage live migration to move the virtual hard disks, and then it associates the virtual hard disk with the UNC path. So virtual hard disks is the virtual hard disk itself. The virtual machine is the VMC file, and this is going to be an XML file that contains all the definitions for the virtual machines. Every single configuration that you make on the virtual machine will be stored in this configuration file. So these should be somewhere safe. They should be somewhere redundant. They should be somewhere on the network. In a pinch, you can store them locally, but the whole idea behind separation of compute and storage is that they're going to be stored somewhere where there's got resilient storage and you've got, you know, redundant paths and that sort of thing to the storage. Okay, so that's the first thing that you're probably going to want to configure is where the storage is. So I just went through and I configured it on one. You want to configure this on each of your Hyper-V hosts. So you want to register each one and configure them to the same path. Okay, so second thing you're probably going to want to configure if you go to Hyper-V settings is going to be live migration support. So right now, if I click live migrations, there is no live migration support. If I check this button, it means it's going to allow two simultaneous live migrations. Now, what live migration allows you to do is move a working workload, a spinning workload, from one Hyper-V host to another. You might be moving it because you're having problems with one of the hosts. You might be moving it because you're patching a host. You might be moving it because, you know, it isn't needed anymore and you're going to move it off and archive it somewhere. There's lots of reasons. But essentially, you can use any available network. Or if you've got a dedicated NIC team, a lot of times you're going to have a dedicated NIC team or a dedicated NIC just for live migration, then you can specify the IP address for that. And as long as that IP address corresponds to the NIC, which you've got set up for NIC for live migration, then it's going to cause that virtual machine to be migrated, and that's going to be hard disk and memory. It's going to cause it to be migrated on a network that isn't going to affect guests. And that's the whole idea of having dedicated networks for that. Storage live migration, very similar, except storage live migration is turned on by default. And what it does is it keeps the virtual machine spinning on this Hyper-V host, but it moves the storage someplace else. So if you're having CPU pressure on one of your Hyper-V hosts, then the very first step you should do is probably consider moving your storage off of the Hyper-V host. Get it away from direct attached storage. That's the fastest way to peg the CPU in the Hyper-V host. So as you start scaling your storage up, that moves you more into a pooling model. So if you needed to scale your storage without scaling your CPU and your memory, you just go to wherever your storage is and throw some more disks at it, put some more spindles at it. If it's Windows Server 2012 R2 and you've got a storage space and that's where you're storing your VHD files, then you can add disks, you can add virtual disks, and you can basically scale up your storage pool and your storage space on the fly without having to recreate it, change the resiliency model, anything. So it's very flexible, and you don't have to have any specific tools to do it. You can just use Server Manager or PowerShell to do it. Okay, replication configuration. So replication configuration, this is where you turn on and configure Hyper-V replica. Now, if I enable Hyper-V replica on this box, that just simply sets it up so that I can take virtual machines that are running here and I can sync them up on another Hyper-V host. So one of the benefits of server consolidation is the ability to migrate workloads live, and it is the ability to keep warm standbys of workloads. I can't tell you how many companies I go into, even medium-sized companies that should be, you know, pretty on top of their disaster recovery, don't have a disaster recovery plan, don't have a business continuity plan, wouldn't know what to do if they lost a critical workload. They would walk around going, what should I do? How would I recover this workload? And they start thinking about it at the time that the problem happens. So your SLA should define how long you've got to recover a specific workload. Even if you're a small company, you should have some sort of an SLA, even if it's just to keep your own guys honest. So when you start talking about Hyper-V replica, it just simply creates a warm standby so that if the virtual machine VHD file was corrupted, lost, something went wrong with it on this server, then I've got another copy of it that's up to date within, and you can set the replica time here of as little as 30 seconds. And it'll just replicate snapshots every 30 seconds to it. And then as I fire it up, it'll spin that virtual machine up on the second Hyper-V host, and then because it's going to come up, it's going to have the same IP address, it's going to have the same DNS server. The only thing you might have to worry about would be kind of similar to what happens in a regular cluster, is stale ARP cache. So if it comes up comes up on another Hyper-V host, and then it's going to obviously come up with the same IP address because it's replicated, then anybody that's been communicating with it, there might be like a 30-second timeout between the time that that new virtual machine comes up and they can communicate with it just because they've got the MAC address cached. So most of the time, especially with version 2 virtual machines, as they come up, they clear the ARP cache and they send a broadcast out to say, for this IP address, clear your ARP cache. And anybody that's got an ARP 2 client, which is Windows 7 and above, will hear that and clear the ARP cache for that IP address. So generally, that's not even an issue anymore. But anyway, Hyper-V Replicate is something that you get benefits from right off the bat with server consolidation, because now you don't have to have, you know, a physical image of the server. You don't have to have a physical backup of the server. You don't have to install the server in order to recover all the data. You just simply bring that server up, bring that virtual machine up on another Hyper-V host, and you're back in business again. So how do you get started creating your virtual machines? Pretty simple process. You can either do this with PowerShell, you can do this with the console, but if I'm going to create my first virtual machine, I would just go New Virtual Machine, click Next, and I'll just call this one Console 1, Consolidation Project 1. You can see it takes the default path. Click Next. You can do Gen 1 or Gen 2. Unless you've got a reason to be compatible with 2008 R2, then you can do a Gen 2. If it's a brand new virtual machine, always do a Gen 2. But Gen 1 is for backward compatibility to 2008 R2 and Server 2012 Hyper-V hosts. Okay, and then startup memory. If we use dynamic memory, then it will only allocate memory that it needs when it needs it, and this will take a little bit of buffering on the Hyper-V host, but essentially what it's going to do is allow you to use the minimum amount of memory required to give you the highest level of virtual machine density on that Hyper-V host. If I don't check dynamic memory, it maxes out at 512, will automatically allocate 512. So if this is your typical Windows Server 2012 R2 machine, you'd probably do something like this, 2 gigs of RAM. If you say dynamic memory, then the startup memory, I could set that something lower, you know, set it to 784, for example, and then it will allocate memory as it needs it and much more efficient. Now, I'm not connected right now. I'm going to go ahead and create this as a not connected virtual machine, and then I'm going to create a couple of virtual switches and show you how to connect the virtual machines to the virtual switches. Okay, you can see it's going to create a virtual hard disk file for me. Otherwise, I can use an existing virtual hard disk file. The reason you'd bring in an existing virtual hard disk file is if you already brought it up in a test mode, you've copied the file out to the destination, and you just want to point to it. Okay, we'll install an operating system later, and we'll click Finish. All right, so there is our virtual machine. Now, to create a switch, I'm going to come down to Hyper-V Settings, actually Hyper-V Switch Manager. There's three types of switches we can create. We can create an external switch, an internal switch, and a private switch. An external switch has to point to a physical NIC on the machine. Whenever this guest OS has to communicate with the outside world, in other words, it has to go outside of the Hyper-V host, you have to connect it to an external switch. And an external switch has to map to a physical NIC. So if I create a new external switch, you can see it'll show me whatever NICs are in the system. I've got two physical NICs in the system. If I dedicate one and I say allow management operating system to share this network, then I'm still going to see this switch or this NIC if I go into my adapter settings on the management OS, which is this OS. If I say don't allow it, which is what you should be doing because you don't want contention between the OS and Hyper-V, then you say don't allow management, and that adapter will completely disappear from the adapter settings in the management OS. And what that does is it eliminates the possibility that somebody could go in and misconfigure the adapter or make a change to the adapter while the Hyper-V hosts are using it. So the best practice is not to allow management of the operating system. If you're short on NICs, a lot of companies do because they use the NIC for not only guest OS access but for management OS access, which is a no-no. You should have at least two NICs. You should have one for guest OS and one for management OS, and then you can turn off the management OS for the one that you set up as your external switch. Then you give the switch a name and hit apply. So if you're remote desktoped in and you're actually using the remote desktop session on that switch that you just enabled, your remote desktop session is going to drop, and you're going to have to go back in and establish it to the other NIC. So be ready for that if you're doing all your management with remote desktop. So this is a configuration you should probably do locally in front of the Hyper-V host, just in case you don't have KVI access to it. So that's an external switch. I'm not going to create one here because I've just got my session is using that NIC. However, I will create an internal switch for you so you see how this works. All right, so the second type of switch is an internal switch. Internal switch, if I create a NIC and I map it to an internal switch, it can see every other virtual machine on that host, and it can see the host. If I create a private switch, then it can only see other virtual machines on that host, but it cannot see the host. So what's the benefit of seeing the host? It allows you to transfer files using a map drive between the host and a virtual machine or a guest OS running on that host. So if I create a new internal switch, I'll just call this one Contoso Internal. Notice it doesn't map to any next external NIC cards because it doesn't have any access outside of the Hyper-V host. The furthest it can go is to the Hyper-V host itself. So I'll hit Apply and I'll hit OK. All right, now I'll go to Consolidation 1. I'll go into Settings. Okay, and you can see that the network adapter is there, but it hasn't been mapped to anything. Now I'll go ahead and map it to that internal switch. And I'll hit Apply and OK. So for testing purposes, you probably want to just get the virtual machines that are going to be consolidated up and running on the virtual, on the Hyper-V host, using an internal switch so they don't see the outside, there's no contention with the outside, and then before you switch them over to an external switch, you should go through and make sure that you don't have anything running in the Hyper-V environment, which could possibly cause problems in your production environment. For example, if you've got a domain controller running that you set up to test with, you want to make sure that if that domain controller is not really part of your actual domain, you don't bring it up and connect it to the external switch. So really do your due diligence checks before you bring them up live. But essentially, once you get all your virtual machines running that have your workloads on them that were running on bare metal before, you can give access to this console using just, if I wanted to connect to this, I could basically just double click on it, start it up, and then connect to it and allow, for example, somebody that knows the application to go through and test the application. I could, if I wanted to, sandbox it off on a network that doesn't see anything and put an external switch up there for just a dedicated network that doesn't see the rest of the world and let somebody that knows the application log on remotely and test it that way. So having a test environment and getting everything up and running before you expose it to the world is a pretty good practice. Then, once you're ready to go, workload by workload, start dropping them out onto the external network. So you're basically just going to go and switch them. So if I had the external network, I'd go back in here and I'd go to Settings. And I'd come into my network adapter and I'd switch it over to the external network. I don't have one, but if I had an external network, this is where I'd do it. And then as soon as you do that and hit OK, that machine is visible. So, supporting that the IP address is addressable by everybody else, it's visible, it's going to register with DNS, and this is going to be your first workload that you release. And then you're going to go through workload by workload, bring them up, build them, test them, back them up, and have a process, have a means that you do this, have a framework for releasing this. And then once you get your workloads up that you consider part of your server consolidation project, stabilize it. Go through, get it tested, get it marked off. Yes, it's done. Yes, it's good. We version this as 1.0 of the virtual machine. And then you're basically beginning your consolidation. So a lot of SMB customers, they approach this in a more of a cost savings means. They do this because they're saving money, but they don't see the hidden benefits in having a consolidated environment, the portability of the hard drives, the easy disaster recovery, the ability to do disaster recovery, live migration. So a lot of partners have to not only sell the functionality that you get with server consolidation, but also show that, your operating costs are going to go down, but your capital expenditure cost for infrastructure should go way down. So the whole idea of a server consolidation project, like we talked about in the earlier part one of the clip, is basically to bring the management infrastructure a little closer to home, a little easier to work with, make things more portable, but also to save money. you know, and upgrading is really kind of one of those things where when you upgrade your host, you don't have to upgrade the virtual machines that are on there because they're just virtualized. So scaling, I mean, there's all sorts of benefits to it. But for right now, I'm going to go ahead and wrap this up. This is how you would set up your initial consolidation project. And then, you know, obviously the devil is in the details, but this should get you going with how to create virtual machines, create a virtual switch, and understand a little bit of the settings that you would do in a brand new Hyper-V host. Thanks.